If you're feeling a little cabin feverish, take a little winter road trip to Ottawa, Illinois, a fun, friendly, charming destination with boutique shops, small-town coffee shops, award-winning locally brewed beer, and all kinds of excellent casual and fine dining. Log on to visitottawail.com today.
Today is Wednesday. It is February 19th, 2025, and it's 2:37 in the afternoon. And hi, this is John Williams. You are listening to the Mincing Rascals podcast, the podcast for people who care about Chicago. Catch my show on WGN Radio weekdays from 10 to 2.
I'm Austin Bird from the Illinois Policy Institute and co-founder of Iron Light, a marketing agency working to change the world. You can check out my book, The New Chicago Way.
I'm Kate Plies, former Chicago reporter, columnist, now doing the Chicago history website, Roseland, Chicago, 1972.
And I'm Brandon Pope from WCIU and contributor to numerous other platforms.
Hey, by the way, guys, I didn't mention to you this before we got started, but I am going to ask you to do red light, green light, yellow light. If you've got something you suggest people do see, don't see, or maybe proceed cautiously, I'm going to just tell you what I'm going to say. I'm going to tell you that Anora, which some people think might be the picture of the year this year, is a definite yellow light, okay? Watched it last night, was hoping to laugh, didn't laugh once.
You're hoping to laugh?
I heard it was supposed to be funny. It was naughty.
Someone gave you really bad advice. Oh, man.
Do not take your parents to see this, okay? Okay, listen, I know about rewriting history. We understand the concept. But the latest trick from Donald Trump seems to be rewriting the present, forgetting that line of tanks heading into Ukraine a few Februaries ago. The president said about Volodymyr Zelensky, "Today I heard, oh, well, we weren't invited." Well, you've been there for 3 years, the president said. You should have ended it after 3 years. You should have never started it. You could have made a deal. Today he called Zelensky a dictator. He also criticized Zelensky for his low approval rating of 4%. In fact, Zelensky was elected in 2019 with 73% of the vote. His most recent approval rating is 57%. Elections meant to take place last spring have been postponed because of the war. Add to that Trump's post that he who saves his country does not violate the law, and you have a man who is uninterested in the truth and the law. Zelensky said Trump lives in a disinformation space. But tell me if you agree with this. The results of all of this will not be good because Republicans like hearing him talk like this, but they will not like the results.
Well, yeah, I think putting that quote against his criticism of Zelensky is very interesting. I will mention Trump said a lot of things in that post about Ukraine, but one that jumped out to me and that it could offer some historical context for is this idea that because Ukraine does not have elections, ergo, the current administration is not legitimate. And I would remind people of the fact that the United States is very, very rare and unique in holding elections during, one, our Civil War, and two, during World War II. And most of the time, when you're in really, really serious conflict, especially what like the one Ukraine is facing, you do not have elections. And that does not mean that this government is necessarily corrupt. The other thing I would note, that Napoleon quote, or potentially misquote, yeah, we don't really know, yeah, Napoleon said that, but is reflective of some elements of what some people call the new right. And I would encourage people to understand better some of the rhetoric and thinking behind that wing, or that sector of the right wing. I would say sort of the intellectual leader of that is this guy named Curtis Yarvin, who was interviewed recently in the last month by the New York Times. And this is a guy who essentially says democracy is a god that failed and we need something like a benevolent dictator or monarchy. Mm-hmm. And his argument for that is, look, you know, the Apple computer that I'm speaking to you on, that was made by a monarchy called Apple. There's a guy at the top and he decides everything. And therefore, you know, it's not that scary to think of a country that's like that. There's many problems with that argument, one of which is that Apple does not have a monopoly on the use of force in society, for example. That's why it's different than a government. But I think people need to take those thinkers who were quite fringe in the last, decade quite seriously, because that's where that kind of rhetoric comes from.
He was championed by J.D. Vance, right? And this guy,
Vance, I believe, knew him.
Yeah.
I don't know to what extent he championed him.
Kind of plucked him from obscurity for most of us. He was this guy who'd been writing and thinking and talking out there, and he was never going to matter. But then Vance sort of championed and repeated some of the things he said. Vance has Trump's ear to some degree or another, and now that guy's writings and thinkings are a little scary relevant. I'm not sure relevant, but they're in the conversation now.
Every day, we're steeping further and further, and I want to avoid buzzwords, but the buzzwords are becoming a reality. And the rhetoric that Donald Trump has been using, the people he's choosing to ally with, it's nothing short of authoritarianism. He's got all the positive words for Russia, nothing positive for Ukraine, only negative. All of a sudden, Zelensky's a dictator, and he's criticizing Ukraine for not holding elections, but who holds elections in wartime? When you think about most of these nations when they're invaded, they don't. I mean, the UK didn't hold elections from, I believe, a decade because of the war at the time. And then to insinuate that Ukraine started the war, that's like insinuating that America attacked Japan at Pearl Harbor. That's not what happened at all.
Are we misreading that quote of his about Zelensky starting the war? I mean, I know that he around that line was the idea that they should have settled or negotiated this. They could have done something to get themselves out of harm's way, but Zelensky wasn't able to accomplish that. Do you guys think he really is saying that Ukraine started the war in Ukraine? I mean, I'm looking for a way out of that.
I think he's really saying it. I think the question we need to ask is, why is Donald Trump saying this, and why is he in such a rush to become an ally to Russia? What's building here, I don't want to be alarmist, but it's being laid out pretty clearly, is Trump wants to ally with Russia. We see the rest of the EU and European nations saying firmly, no, we're going to back Ukraine. Like, that don't look good. And then to what ends? Where does it stop? Everything is backwards here, but I think the question needs to be asked is, why? Why does Donald Trump keep sucking up to Putin and Russia? Because even Republicans in his own party are having to come out and backtrack that.
You know, which senators have today.
Makes no sense.
Answer some of those questions, Kate.
Oh, why not? Okay, yeah, let me just solve everything right now. I don't think we have gotten wrong what Donald Trump said. When I first heard it paraphrased that he had said that, I thought, oh, there's perhaps a little more context that would make this statement make some sort of sense. But then I heard the entire clip, and no, there isn't really any more context to make it more sense. He has always had the attitude that Ukraine was just asking for it by being there and having such nice land, sort of thing. And that's really all it is. If you've heard the actual recording, it's actually more shocking even than reading it, because he sounds like really mad at Ukraine. Like they're such a bad kid, not a naughty child, but like,
I think that's an interesting point, but I think he was angry, not so much because of the point he was making, but because Zelensky, after the meeting with Putin, said, I need to be invited in on that conversation. And
right.
I'm not going to endorse anything that we weren't a part of. We need to be at the table. And then Trump.
Exactly.
So this is Trump's retort to Zelensky's very logical, justified complaint. So now he's mad at him.
You're so right, because what he actually says is, and now I'm hearing
right.
that Ukraine thinks they should be there. Yeah, I imagine you would hear that. And of course, as we know, the first Ukraine knew that there was going to be an actual peace meeting was when they read about it in the newspapers themselves. As for his Napoleon statement, I'm maybe not as exercised about it as some people, in the sense that I don't necessarily think he's attempting to be Napoleon per se. I think he heard a phrase from Vance or whatever. It sounded good to him. He typed it out. I think that's,
I don't even think he typed it out.
The level of his thinking.
Yeah, he can't quote Napoleon. He can't quote Napoleon to save his life.
Of course not.
I can't quote Napoleon to save my life. I didn't know that was a Napoleon quote.
Right. He should be quoting from something like Gladiator. That's what he might.
Andrew Jackson. Somebody.
I can immediately think of quotes from Gladiator that would make sense for Donald Trump to be tweeting out, right? Are you not entertained, right? That would be a perfect thing for
him.
Oh,
my God, that is going to happen in our lifetime. What's the over-under on how long before he says that?
I will have my vengeance, right? I mean, but so why would he go for Napoleon? I presume it means that Vance has mentioned it to him.
So, Austin, play armchair psychiatrist or psychologist here. This does fall into my little category of attraction-distraction.
It is a distraction, but it highlights the importance of understanding what is emerging as sort of a Trumpian political ideology that's very different from conservatism as such, or you know, any kind of traditional political ideology we've seen in the White House over the last, you know, 20 years. And I think part of that ideology is a, maybe not monarchy in a literal sense, but when you look at the coalition that has been built around Trump, it is more similar to one of a king or some kind of dynastic ruler than the administrative, you know, the literal administrator of the president. Mm-hmm. And people who vote for him do not vote for his ideas as such. They're voting for this man and really whatever he says. Because this is our guy. He's standing up to the people we dislike, and you know, he's our bully pulpit. So that explains this wide range of policy positions and opinions he can have outside of, say, even the norms of the right, because it's him, and it's not about the idea. So when it comes to Ukraine, like the thing that comes to mind for me is, yeah, there ultimately has to be some kind of a deal in Ukraine. Like Russia is probably not going to just leave. That's been proven. And so in the interest of all humanity and to minimize suffering and death, there probably needs to be a deal reached. And Trump's thinking is that screw this Zelensky guy. He thinks he needs to be in on the deal. He has no leverage on me. We're funding him. So I'm going to tell him what's what, and I'm going to try to get Americans to turn on Zelensky. That's going to be very hard because Americans have a very, very low opinion of Vladimir Putin. So I think he's trying to drag Zelensky down to that level, like before making a deal like
this. Right, vilify him. But then the idea would be that not only does Russia keep Crimea, but the whole southeast corner of the, not only the land that they have since acquired, but then also build a land bridge along the coast that they would actually have a huge swath of Ukraine is what Putin wants and is what Trump has proposed. In fact, Trump said they may all be Russians someday. I don't know why he said that. There he said that. Let's go back to the original question, though. Do you think that Republicans like hearing him talk this way, but they're not going to like the results? And that's an umbrella statement about not only his policies or thoughts about Ukraine, but about Israel and Gaza, about Doge, about all of the, about the federal firings. I think they yeah, 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 and until there are real consequences of that. And 3 weeks is not enough time to have had real consequences of that. So I'm still holding out that as nutty as all of this is, it's not going to be as bad as it is scary right now.
I think you could very well be right about that. I think that may come more, though, because of pushback that I am sure we have already seen and we will continue to see in the courts, because they have been so sloppy about how they have gone about their executive orders and their Doge slashing, that a lot of that is going to get reversed in the courts. I think that's probably the safest thing, because I don't see the Republicans in Congress wanting to push back on this.
Or and if it's not the courts, Kate, maybe it's just in the general populace that the congressmen will feel that. People losing their jobs in the federal system right now voted for Trump. It's not just blue. It's just not blue people mm-hmm. that are getting it. Red people are getting it, too.
Yeah,
that's going to be take a little bit longer to filter yep. down to each congressperson yep. as to just yep. how much of a pushback they're getting from their constituents.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's going to take a while to see.
It's going to be a long 24 months.
What's in 24 months? You're talking about the midterms?
I'm talking about the midterms, which we will inevitably see. It happens for every incumbent president, a referendum and a flip. But I feel like people are not going to forget the pain inflicted here. And I think about also just the rollbacks on things like having a cultural club on campus, like potentially not having historically black fraternities and sororities on campuses, because somehow that's evil. Like, these are things people are not going to forget because it impacts their livelihood and their way of life. It's not going to look good.
I wonder how many Muslim Americans voted for Trump, and we know that that was a swing vote, who, having seen that Donald Trump is willing to just kick everybody out of Gaza, I wonder how they feel about those votes now, too. It just seems to me like in time, these things are going to start to resonate in real ways to people. Austin, do you think there's a wave coming and it's not that far away?
Brandon's right that there will be a referendum. And I think there's one emerging kind of along cultural lines where you have, and I'm speaking in the most broadish brush possible, you had a period of, call it woke-ism or woke-left dominance in institutions for 4 years, and maybe like a soft version of that, like for 4 years or 8 years prior to that. And there's a bunch of criticisms from the center and the right about that. And now we are going to see what an anti-woke right does. And it will be things like what Brandon mentioned. And there are many examples of that. And we're going to see this sort of new cultural right, how people react to that. And one example I saw of this yesterday, which freaked me out, was an ASMR video of deportation of illegal immigrants. And that was with... I can't remember what federal agency put that out, but ASMR videos are like videos online where people are crinkling paper. Or
it
like
was shared by the White House.
Yeah. It wasn't from the White House, Brandon?
Yeah. Okay. I remember that. Yeah.
Describe the video. Like, what are you talking about?
Describe the video is essentially, and by the way, this process happens under every single president, and this is how we deport people. But there's essentially people in chains who are walked up a flight of stairs into an airplane.
Okay, I've seen that.
So you're hearing sort of the clinging and clanging of these chains and them being, you know, locked around wrists. That I would describe as sort of an anti-woke, trollish, right, like vocabulary and marketing that you've not seen before from a sitting president in, like, you know, the modern presidency. And I think that will turn a lot of people off who were maybe, you know, say it was people who were squeamish about, you know, say transgender men in women's sports or something like that. And then they see this as the alternative in a more clear picture. I think people could be very turned off by that. But that cultural referendum is going to happen.
I was even thinking more just about people losing their jobs or agencies being so thinned out that now, in order to get an answer from the Veterans Affairs Association, nobody's answering the phone. And the answer
so there, that I feel less certain about, because again, this is the sort of Ezra Klein thing I think I spoke about a week or two ago about the projection of power and fulfilling an agenda versus actually doing it. And if you look at the number of federal employees who have been fired or taken a buyout, it's not that crazy out of line with what natural attrition is in the federal government. So, like, I don't know. And this is the problem with sort of the Doge stuff, with how fast they're moving and how, I mean, they're just getting things wrong about saying we saved $8 billion on this contract and it's actually $8 million. Yeah. I think we have that like at scale right now. I don't think we actually know the extent to which like things are being quote unquote hollowed out or like there's really mass layoffs going on. That might be happening. I just don't think we have enough information to know that right now.
Or isn't happening yet. And maybe it's not sufficiently transparent that you don't trust them anyway. Where's the accountability? But that would be interesting, Austin. So all of this might just be a show of force without actually being as comprehensive. $1 trillion a year. It's not really going to be that.
I think it's a lot of bluster for now. Like if you look at the Doge website, it's just that's counting like the savings, you know? And it's very clearly just it goes up by $4 billion every day. And that's like, but look, it's like it's going up. But the receipts on that are thin, to say the least. So maybe they do a good job. And, you know, I hope that waste and abuse is reduced in federal government. But I do not know. I do not have enough information given to me by Doge and the White House to know if that's happening.
The Republicans are saying we want to cut waste and Democrats don't. I think Democrats want to cut waste, too. They just want to do it a little more methodically, with a little more forethought, with a little more warning. The argument is being struck as, oh, you're not for cutting federal spending. You love all these fat programs. Democrats don't like waste and would be agreeable to some sort of sensible cut.
Yeah, agreed. And I'm sure that they began with things like USAID for the specific reason of knowing that they could poke the Democrats with that and get the kind of response that makes it sound like Democrats want to spend money on anything and not cut. But in general, Democrats have not really done a good job in their response. Take immigration. Immigration is still very, 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 very big issue with people. The recent New York Times poll had just a gigantic percentage, so much bigger than I expected, of people in support of deportations. It was 63% of people actually said that they would like to see everyone deported who had come here in the past 4 years, which I would never have guessed. Now, at the same time, Trump is making this big show, right, of claiming he's going to do these giant deportations. But as we all probably also know, in fact, the numbers haven't even come up yet to the level of the Obama administration. So they're putting a lot of fear out there, the Trump administration. They're making a big show of it, but they're not actually carrying out deportations on this gigantic level that's going to disrupt the economy.
The rascals will continue, but first, if you're feeling a little cabin feverish, and I wouldn't blame you, take a little winter road trip to Ottawa, Illinois, a fun, friendly, charming destination with boutique stores, small town coffee shops, award-winning locally brewed beer, and all kinds of excellent casual and fine dining. Settle down and snuggle up in one of Ottawa's nearly 400 rooms, hotels, private rentals, B&Bs. Start making memories in Ottawa, the middle of everywhere. Log on to visitottawail.com. Brought to you by Ottawa, the middle of everywhere, and the Illinois Office of Tourism. Now back to the Mincing Rascals. Let me ask you about J.B. Pritzker for a minute. He spoke today saying Illinois community colleges should be able to offer four-year degrees. Smartphones should be banned from all public school classrooms. The kids can't have them. He warned about the fascism that is creeping or steamrolling into our government. He said the seed that grew into a dictatorship in Europe a lifetime ago did not arrive overnight. It started with everyday Germans mad about inflation, looking for someone to blame. And he also said, my oath is to the Constitution of our state and our country. We don't have kings in America, and I don't intend to bend the knee to one. I am not speaking up in service to my ambition, but in deference to my obligations. I'm not so sure about the last part of that. I think he's definitely speaking up to his ambitions. He's talking like somebody that's early out on the campaign stump. But he said, we don't have kings. And I thought it was ironic because right after that moved today, Donald Trump tweeted about killing congestion pricing in Manhattan. New York is saved. Long live the king. That's the difference between those two. One thinks it's a criticism and one thinks it's an attaboy.
I think J.B. Pritzker deserves a lot of respect and credit for doing what I think a lot of Democrats, elected officials, and people in general are scared to do. And that's to call what we're seeing what it is. He laid it out plainly. We have so many parallels going on from what Trump is doing and what happened with Nazi Germany. It's blatant. It's clear. At the same time, just in this past hour, White House accounts are tweeting out things about Trump being a king, showing images of Trump as a monarch. It's pretty obvious at this point that we are headed toward a fascist type of system, if that's the way, if it goes the way Trump wants it to. So kudos to J.B. Pritzker for being one of the only prominent Democrats to actually go forth and not be afraid to lean in and say what we're actually seeing. Obviously, he's got ambitions for 2028. He's got ambitions to run for president. And at this point, he's the leader of the clubhouse because he's the only one that can actually speak truth to power at this moment.
It's right to see it as campaign speech. We did some polling last week, which I thought was very interesting, on J.B. Pritzker's favorables across the state. And it's about 50-50. He's a little bit above water. So 50% of Illinoisans have favorable opinion, 47% unfavorable in that same poll. And the reason for that is that that same poll found 52% of voters said high taxes are the number one issue facing the state. And state governance was 26%, number two. And then crime and the economy were tied at 24%. So I think a lot of the coverage of J.B. Pritzker is going to be around presidential politics, which is good for J.B. Pritzker. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's good for the state of Illinois. Mm-hmm. And right now, I mean, in that speech, he said Illinois is a great place for jobs. The private sector in Illinois since 2020 has added 500 jobs. 500 in the private sector. That is a dismal number. And we have to look at...
You must mean net. And even that sounds hard to believe.
Net 500 private sector jobs, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, since January 2020. So J.B. Pritzker is going to have very compelling rhetoric against the president. A lot of it will be deserved. But I would just implore people to remember... that he is the highest ranking public official in Illinois, and our state has a lot of problems beyond response to the federal government that really need a leader to address. And that goes for everybody in every corner of the state.
That kind of ties in with JB's cute little video last week trolling Trump over the Gulf of Mexico name change to Gulf of America. It was a cute video.
Which he said he was going to rename Lake Michigan Lake Illinois.
Do we really want him drawing that kind of direct attention to Illinois, making us a target? It's kind of feeding into that same thing, him making Trump the focus of his budget address. The state budget, like any other state budget, is dependent on quite a bit of federal funding. Nearly 33% of overall state funding. So you know, how much of an enemy do we want to make of Donald Trump when he could really, really put the hurt on?
Talk about that M3 Strategies poll of Illinois voters last week, Austin. It came up with these findings. 36% strongly approve of Trump's performance so far. 49% strongly disapprove of Trump's performance so far here in Illinois. Does those numbers sound high or low for you?
Those sound about in line with where Illinois shook out in the presidential election. And I was talking about a different poll that Illinois Policy did, but this M3 poll is commissioned by Dave Nyack, I believe, who ran for state Senate and it seems to be thinking about running for governor in Illinois. That also had rankings on Doge, and it was interesting to see how unpopular Doge was, or that idea, in Illinois and Elon Musk. But so Pritzker is right that politically, this is what the people of Illinois want to hear. Like, to Brandon's point, people of Illinois very much, according to this polling, and I think as we saw in the election, a pretty large chunk of the state would like the governor to be doing this. So you can't blame him if he's trying to run for president, doing that. But I do think his approval rating among state residents shows that you kind of have to deliver more than that. And taking your eye off the ball to just go at the federal government and be strategizing about how to get media play, how to work with other governors, how to become a national media figure, it's not necessarily in the best interest of the state.
There's a movement afoot. One Republican from the Rockford area, we talked to him today, wants Illinois to have its own Doge-style program. And I say, sure, let's do it. But I advised him when we talked to him today, John Cabello, I said, don't call it Doge, because that's a toxic word. 32%, according to this survey, strongly approve of the job that Elon Musk and Doge are doing. In Illinois, 32% strongly approve, 50% strongly disapprove. I wonder what the national numbers are on that. They may be a flip of that. Certainly they would be in some states. But the renaming of the Gulf of Mexico is strongly supported in Illinois by 23% of our citizens. 50% strongly disapprove of it. I wonder why that 50% isn't higher, except maybe it's not an issue that rises to the level of strongly disapprove. Who cares? It doesn't warrant that kind of concern. But here's a question that I thought was interesting. Which best describes your belief on undocumented immigrants? We are a country of laws, or we are a country of immigrants? That strikes me as a loaded question on this survey. I'm not even sure I understand what it's getting at. Which best describes your belief on undocumented immigrants? We are a country of laws, 45% said that, or we are a country of immigrants, 47% said that. It suggests that we can't be both, and that's a biased question.
That's a vibe check question. So it's basically saying, do you think, if you think we're a nation of immigrants versus a nation of laws, what you're saying is, yeah, I don't like our laws around immigration, and I think we should have much more immigration, or I don't think deportation is right, right? If you're saying we're a nation of laws, it's saying, yeah, we need, I favor a more strict, stringent approach to immigration enforcement. And I think what that's showing is that Illinois is, even though it's a blue state nominally, it's kind of split on that, which I think is interesting.
But it doesn't give me a chance to say that we should follow the law, but do everything we can to embrace the migrant population.
So, for example, if I was asked that question, I think we should have much more immigration. I think we need to have 1 billion Americans. I'm very, very pro more immigration. I would still answer that question, we're a nation of laws. Because I think if you're not a nation of laws, you don't have anything, right? But it's making you pick. It's forcing you to pick. No nuance.
Right, because my answer to this question is we're a nation of laws. I mean, that has to be preeminent. It doesn't seem like the laws matter much right now, but I mean, that's our life raft.
It's a false choice. So, yeah, the only thing you're getting out of that is you are shaking out a certain hardcore percentage of people who are willing to make the choice. And at least say to a surveyor, to me, laws are more important than immigrants, or immigrants are not compatible with laws. It's not really telling us a whole lot, but it is giving us that sort of hardcore percentage of people.
Do y'all agree that we should have a Doge office in Illinois, Brandon? I mean, if you thought about it, if I put you in charge of Doge, and I didn't ask you to do it unilaterally, but I mean, even if I did, I would trust you, Brandon. I'll bet you could go through and slash. Illinois has plenty of fat that any sensible person could cut. So Cabello has this idea of the Senate and House Republican and Democrat leaders, along with somebody from the Inspector General's office, or something like that. We'd have this committee. And then when I asked him, okay, then after they identify cuts, how do you execute those? Then how do we actually eliminate the spending? Well, he didn't have all the details yet. But I mean, if we had something with some teeth, let's go, right?
Not having all the details yet sounds exactly like what's happening with Doge on the federal level. I mean, hey, I think everyone's in favor of cutting waste, saving money, saving taxpayer dollars. At the end of the day, are you doing it responsibly? But yeah, I think Illinois should absolutely have something like that. Every state should. I'm surprised that every state doesn't. But it's got to be done responsibly. It's also got to take into consideration, once you make these cuts, what are you going to do with the saved money? Are you just going to just net from there? Or are you going to reestablish those funds and reappropriate them into better purposes? That, I think that makes for a very interesting debate right now with DOGE. On a federal level, there's no plan to reappropriate any of that money that is allegedly being saved. But I think you could do some pretty cool things and solve some problems.
No. That's the but that's no. Don't take the savings and spend it.
just savings for savings' sake, right?
Well, I don't know.
It's all supposed to go back in our pockets.
It's either supposed to go back or pay down the bills that we already have.
No rebates. Yeah. No relief, no helping fix the broken healthcare system.
You know, this was an issue in Minnesota. When I lived in Minnesota, they were the opposite of Illinois. They had more money collected than they had allocated. And so the question was, do we put it in a rainy day fund or do we give people rebates? And that was a nice problem to have. I'm trying to remember how they resolved that. But I do think there were rebate checks that actually went out to Minnesotans. But you're suggesting that we then find better ways to spend that money. And the idea is to not spend the money at all, to eliminate people and thin programs.
If that's ultimately the way it goes, then great if it's being done responsibly. I think on a federal level, the big issue with DOGE is like the biggest things that the United States is spending money on are things that people need. Defense, Social Security, Medicare.
Interest on the debt.
Food stamps.
Yeah.
Those take up the majority of the money. So if you're going to take money from that, well, that's irresponsible. And so I think on a state level, if we're going to do that, it's got to be the same approach. It's got to be responsible. Are you really cutting waste? Are you cutting things that ideologically you just don't like?
That's why going after USAID was just so punching down. It was just taking the skinniest kid on the playground and kicking him because you can. And you really don't want to fight the tough kids. So when
that was definitely their idea. And the Democrats, rather than just opposing that program by program at USAID, really should be coming out with a positive alternative. And for instance, one thing that's been floated a few times but never come to fruition is having an actual organized audit system where every certain number of years, every agency and department kind of comes up for review. And there's an audit of the department and they have to defend themselves and say, this is what we're doing, this is what we're doing it with, and absolutely justify all their expenses, all their personnel. So you're doing it in a structured, organized way, agency by agency, and places could be either maybe cut out completely, but probably just trimmed. Since it's been floated, you know that it's already written up and could be easily resurrected and introduced as an actual positive alternative. And that would show that the Democrats do care about trimming government.
And making cuts that make sense, because Sean Hannity had President Trump and Vice President Musk on yesterday, and while they were talking, they did a split screen. There's Trump, Hannity, and Musk, and then on the right-hand side of your screen, they had a scroll of all of the stupid things that USAID was spending money on. So it was $75,000 for a DEI ballet in Ireland, and just like nutty, bizarre stuff. And some of it was true, some of it wasn't. You know, it was kind of a distraction, and it just... In a trillion-dollar economy, it just wasn't important. But that was the sort of justification for decimating this program.
Right. And what you say is true. It's not a lot of money compared to the federal budget, but it's just not – it's something like 0.7%, I think, is the number that I read.
Yeah.
But it's still not for the Democrats to say, don't worry about 0.7% of the budget, 0.07% of the budget. Don't worry about this $1 trillion. It doesn't matter, because we all know from our own budgets that while the biggest part of our budget, maybe housing or whatever, yes, is the most important, we all know that the way our budgets really crash is by 1,000 cuts, right? Buying too much at Starbucks, buying too much at this, spending too much at Costco, and it's just not a good look for
people. Yeah, but I also think the equivalent of that would be if you were doing that with a household budget, it would be $5 coffee, and it would be went to the movie for $12, bought the popcorn, and that's $19, blah, 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 blah. Meanwhile, over here is the mortgage, $2,400, and that didn't scroll up, you know? Car payment, $600.
The Democrat response to all of this, in my opinion, has been so misguided scattershot. If I am their comms person, you say, this is a stupid waste of time. Of course, we should eliminate waste. We need to audit the Pentagon. We need to audit the military-industrial complex, where it's giving all this money to billionaires, right?
Like, including Elon, yeah.
Instead, they're defending this stuff that, yeah, it's really small change. But to your point, John, if you have a relative that asks you for a loan because they're in a tough spot and you see them out, like, you know, buying the popcorn and like getting the Starbucks every single day, that's not a good look. You don't think like, you know, they couldn't. It's not in the grand scheme of things. They got bigger problems. It's like, no, like get your stuff together, man. Like, come on, before I lend you any money. So and I think Democrats have a good path to point to for this, which was Bill Clinton in 1993. He had this performance review plan for the entire federal government. Al Gore led it. There's bipartisan legislation around, you know, modernizing and streamlining government. And he had a bunch of executive orders that also cut spending and cut waste. That's the right way to do it. I was so sad this week because the best messenger I saw on this one issue was Stephen A. Smith, because he's trying to run for president. He's like, I want that Clinton surplus. I want the Obama like deportation levels. And that's a good message for Democrats right now. And I it's sad that it has to come from him.
The couple of times I've seen him lately, I've been like, yeah, okay.
He was Stephen really A. Smith.
Yeah.
He would actually be a great 2028 candidate, sad to say.
Like, no, he would not.
Him versus Trump?
I would
Trump?
Like to see him and Al Franken. Let me see the both of them.
Oh, my God. You guys do not want to. You guys want to lose even more. I thought Barkley.
I want to see them on a debate stage.
That's a different answer to the question, okay. Who do you want to run again? Of all of the athletes who I've ever seen talk politics, Steve Kerr, I think, would make an honest, smart person. Charles Barkley would make an honest, smart, hilarious person and super candid.
Are we just looking at sports people here?
Kind of. But Stephen A. Well, only because I'm thinking of Stephen A. Smith, who I think is great at what he does. And my kids don't agree with me on that. His personality is too strident. But I think he knows what he does for a living, and I think he does it. You know, I think that's his job, and I think he's really good at it.
I agree. He's great at drawing attention. He's great at, you know, being a face and being a loud and boisterous and telling it like it is. And honestly, the Democrats, that's their number one criticism, is they just don't speak like ordinary people speak. Stephen A. Smith, he definitely doesn't hold back. So, look, if Trump could be president, I think all the rules are out the window in terms of qualifications.
Well, there you go. At this point.
So, I don't think he'd be a great president. I'm not saying all that. I'm just saying, could he win the election against Trump? Maybe.
You mean for Trump's third term?
Is that what you're talking about? And he can push the other Democrats more in the direction of speaking like normal people and speaking to real concerns, etc.
Stephen A. Smith does not talk like ordinary people. You know what? But you know the other thing. You know the other thing that Austin made me think of was because we were talking about how Trump and his acolytes right now know how to play to the media, know how to generate imagery that seems to justify or reinforce what they're doing, even if they're not getting much done. And I was reminded of when Clinton and Gore talked about cutting the federal budget, and on the White House lawn, they had pallets of documents that, you know, detailed federal programs. And it was pallets and pallets stacked real high. And there they were standing next to these things. And you go, wow, one of them required a forklift. Look at all the cutting they're doing. That theatrics kind of bugs me. It's sort of like when a White House spokesperson stands there and says, look at all of the cuts we're going to do, and nobody asked to see the piece of paper or whatever that document is they're holding, and sometimes there's nothing on there. It reminds me that we shouldn't be, I guess, wowed or persuaded by some of the theatrics that you see when they're talking about what a good job they're doing.
I also think it was a total missed opportunity for Biden. He had many years to do even just signal to the public that the administration cared about waste at all. I can't think of a single example of that. So that gives the moral high ground to people like Trump and Musk on this issue. They have a lot of leeway because the other side had not talked about this at all.
That's true. I'm quick scanning my brain going, okay, when was the time they made a compelling case for cutting something or demonstrating something? It was always services was always programs, by the way, at a time when we needed them, too. I mean, we were reeling in a pandemic from COVID, a crashed economy.
COVID notwithstanding, but there's non-COVID times also.
I know, but I mean, that's therein was the Biden presidency, right, was the COVID presidency. Okay, let's jump over to the city of Chicago. Mayor Johnson wants to cover the city's budget debt by borrowing $830 million. Help me with this, guys. Principal payments would begin in 20 years. With accrued interest, we'd be out $2 billion for the $830 million we need right now. One market analyst said future taxpayers will be paying for improvements that current taxpayers benefit from. Is that a correct analysis of what the mayor is proposing?
Well, I would just back up a little bit to say that it's not to cover our debt. It's to pay for infrastructure program, capital.
Programs that we have right now. But
right. So not right to cover our current debt that we have. They did refinance some debt recently. So this is separate. This is something that they do on a fairly regular basis to cover giant capital projects.
I guess by budget debt, I meant that they don't have enough money to pay for the programs they have in place or that they are envisioning. They're 830 short. So they want to borrow the money. But by the time you pay that off, you'll be out $2 billion, right? It's a credit card.
And this is an exceptional one, because even though that's a fairly normal process to do, as the marketplace bond people said in all the accounts, this is an exceptional form of it, the extent to which they are backloading the payments so that we're not going to pay anything at all for 2 years. Conveniently, not until after the next municipal elections. And then we're not going to pay any principal for 19 years. For 19 years, no principal. So that's why it's going to be, by at least some accounts, it's going to cost an extra $2 billion in interest to do these $830 million worth of infrastructure things, which are... It's a little unclear to me just how vague the program is in terms of where the money's going, because some of the aldermen have said that it's completely not transparent, but they do have it at least put into some big, you know, categories, certain amount for bridges, certain amount for streetscapes, certain amount for paving streets, that sort of thing.
So the one thing I thought about with this is every time a new mayor comes into office, what do they say in the first year? I can't believe the mess that the last person left for me. These predatory loans, these rapacious deals, all these bankers getting all this money. This is what they're talking about. This specific thing is what they're talking about. And Brandon Johnson is pushing for this $830 million in borrowing. There are big categories. One of those categories, by the way, is aldermanic menu money, which is little play money that we give the aldermen to like basically pay for votes in their own ward.
Well, that's completely unaccountable. Anything they want.
Yeah, that should not be in there. And today there was a vote to send this back to committee, and 27 aldermen voted against sending it back to committee. So then aldermen deferred and published the measure, which means that it needs to be voted on at the next council meeting. That could come as soon as Friday. We had hundreds of people at IllinoisPolicy.org contact their aldermen through our tool, our take action tool there, to say, don't do this deal. And I think that's a really good thing. Of course, if you're funding infrastructure, like if you're building a road and people 30 years from now are going to build the road, debt makes sense because it spreads the life of the payment on, you know, the life of the use of the thing. That's great. I just bought a new HVAC and furnace for my building. I'm going to pay for it, like, not all up front. I'm going to pay for it, like, with no interest kind of for a while because I'm going to use it for a while and it accrues to the value of my house, right? So it's okay to have debt. And that's the argument of, like, Jill Jaworski, the CFO, Jason Irvin, a lot of these people, like, this is normal. It's just debt. No, but what Kate said is what's crazy about it. We don't pay anything toward it for when Brandon Johnson's mayor. And then instead of it just being $830 million in debt, it's $2 billion and future generations are going to pay for it. That's the problem with this.
It does look like it's got enough support to go through when it comes back, even though it got deferred and published. That only takes two aldermen to do that. So since 27 aldermen wanted to vote on it today, presumably they wanted to vote yes on it. And that's certainly how the vote went. It was all, you know, mayoral allies.
So what's going to happen Friday, Kate? How does the vote change?
It probably won't.
Unless
you can get more people
More people should talk to their aldermen and say, this is, redo this. Do not vote no on this. Vote no on this borrowing plan. It's really reckless. And that can change votes because it's a slim margin right now.
Right. I mean, our bond ratings were just brought down to only a couple of degrees above being junk bonds. So we're already going to be paying vastly more interest on these bonds because of that. Brandon Johnson and Jill Jaworski were telling us all through the budget process, oh, no, they're not going to downgrade our bonds. They're not going to downgrade our bonds. Oh, look, they did downgrade the bonds. Moody's, et cetera, said that they might. I'm sorry, Standard & Poor are the ones who did, and Kroll's. They said that they might, and they did. And now they're saying, oh, well, but this $830 million, which is really going to be $2 billion, this extra bit of debt is not going to make them downgrade us even more. It's okay, because when they downgraded us, they already knew we were planning to do this. Our real debt, I mean, this is Jill Jaworski's argument. Our real, and she's CFO of the city, for anyone who doesn't know. And her point was, it's okay because our real debt is in pensions. And so it doesn't matter. When, of course, the ratings agencies are worried about the debt overall, it doesn't really matter to them if the bulk of it is in pensions. If they've already downgraded us and they think we can't pay for our debt and we're going to be adding more at that level, it's a problem. Because to be clear, this is a capital bond issue that only covers 1 year of capital improvements. This isn't some massive program that's going to be, you know, doing stuff for us for the next 10 years.
Oh, that's a good point.
It doesn't make any sense.
Red light, yellow light, green light. My yellow light is officially going to be Enora. I told you at the beginning of this podcast how I felt about that. It may be the front runner now for movie of the year. Might win the Academy for Best Picture. Yellow light. It's a lot of sex. It's a lot of sex, which I'm all for. You know what my point was? I didn't like the characters in the movie. You do have some sympathy for the woman, the stripper, the lady who becomes the bride, et cetera, et cetera. The lead actress is really good in this movie. The lead actor is really good in this movie. I didn't like the movie that much.
I just love this review and the surprise that came with it of Enora. It's great. I'm sure a lot of people are also shocked. I'm going to give a green light to a great Netflix docuseries that just dropped this week, called Court of Gold. It follows the United States Olympic basketball team and the French team, the Serbian team, and the Canadian team, and gives us some unprecedented access to a really awesome Olympic run we saw from four of those teams, and really the rise in basketball on a global level. And of course, Team USA gives you the pride, seeing LeBron and Steph and KD doing their thing. Some great interactions with Barack Obama and rising star Anthony Edwards and stuff like that. It's a really fun docuseries, really well filmed and shot, and it reinforces the fact that in this era where players want to do podcasts and want to call themselves the new media, we still need journalism. We still need storytelling from people who are not the athletes to actually give us these really well done stories and really highlight things that the players really can't. So I'm all about that. It's a great docuseries. It's on Netflix. Check it out.
I saw a great clip from that of Anthony Edwards with Obama. Did you see that part?
Dude, hilarious. It's in episode one. And the way Anthony Edwards like acts like Obama's just some dude.
Was he playing with him, or was he not interested? What was the upshot of that?
You kind of just have to see it. It's like Anthony Edwards, someone's like, you know, hey, he's just some guy. He's like, nah, I'm the truth, man. And he's really like braggadocious. And Brock's like, oh, okay. And he's like, is this you guys' guy? Is him? It's a really fun little interaction. It's also cool that like Barack Obama's just casually hanging around with LeBron James and Steph Curry and all these guys. It's a fun inside look for sure.
I have a giant red light. Do not watch. You're Cordially Invited.
Ooh.
Love Reese Witherspoon. Love Will Ferrell. There was a night last week where we didn't have anything else, you know, going. And I was like, oh, what should we watch? We're It's not time for another episode of Severance, so what should we watch? Oh, you're cordially invited. It must be fantastic. No, it's so terrible. It's just awful.
It didn't look good from the trailers.
Green light on a docuseries I missed last year. I never saw this even come out, and someone told me about it, and it's great. It's on Max, and it's called Stacks, Soulsville, USA. So it's a docuseries about Stacks Records in Memphis. And it tells the whole story of Booker T and the MGs and Otis Redding and Isaac Hayes, and really how that record label played a huge part in racial integration in Memphis. And it's just amazing. It's so good. And the talent and the bravery of a lot of the people working there is just insane. And also how Europe recognized their talent before most of the United States did. And it's just an amazing story. Really good.
What's the platform for the Stacks?
It's on Max. On HBO Max.
Cool. Cool. Right.
That reminds me, this isn't quite fair because I haven't actually seen it, but what I am dying to see is the new Sly and the Family Stone, well, really Sly, documentary. I think it's on Hulu. It's a documentary, not a series. So if you're a big lover of Sly and the Family Stone, this is the thing to watch. It looks like it's amazingly well done from the trailer.
It's on my list for sure. Everyone's hyping it up, and I'm a big Sly and the Family Stone fan. I think I got a vinyl right here, actually.
Hold on, he's reaching over. He's pulling out
Sly and the Family Stone vinyl. So.
It's very like good. We planned
I could
it
go
ahead.
Pull mine out too, but there I'm in the kitchen and they're in the living room.
Your album has the vinyl around it, which means you bought it at in the aftermarket, right? Like in one of those bins.
I noticed that plastic wrap too.
Yeah,
this was gifted to me from Hulu. Actually.
Wow, from Hulu?
Yeah, it was a while ago.
When you subscribe, they send you a record.
Oh, you know, when you're Brandon Pope, they do a little more. I kid.
All right. Well, I don't know how he did that, but that's Brandon Pope, Austin Berg, Kate Plies. I'm John Williams. We're produced by Ben Anderson and Pete Zimmerman. Thank you, everybody. We'll drop another podcast on you next week. I love the props right there.
Yeah, we were props.
What are the chances? All right,
when
guys.
I'm able to do this from home, I got all the props.
Yeah, no kidding. It sounded good. Thanks, guys.
See you guys.
Take it easy.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.